Greetings and salutations all. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. It's been operating since 1982, and it continues every Sunday night at 8 p.m. And I enjoyed the music net that came before us here. Unfortunately for poor Phil Collins, people were discussing Genesis and the other guy who got famous off of it, and they seem to have forgotten poor Phil Collins, who had a good career. Anyway, this is the Limark Technical Net. And as always, I like to tell people the access points for our little net. If you have any questions and you can't get on the technical net, or if you have any puzzles you'd like to share or topics you'd like to hear discussed, or you want me to poke Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at some space report and comment upon it, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Pertinent links will be available either during the end or later on my link page about the stories that are discussed, formulas that are mentioned, topics that are interesting and can be found on a website. You go to my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com, and you'll see links for every week's technical net. So take a look at them when you have nothing better to do, and click on some links and look at some interesting articles and pictures and all kinds of fun stuff. So once again, that's roy.ac2gs.com. Let's see. Always, we have a chat room available. You can either go to Limark's own website and access it through their link, or you can just type in chat.ac2gs.com, and that will land you on our chat room. And hopefully, we are streaming the audio of this technical net on the Internet. So if you have any friends that can't get through with IRLP or Echolink, or with a radio, you can tell them to take their browser and type into it technet.ac2gs.com, and they will be able to hear the streaming as it sounds from my shack. And as always, I want to remind everyone that Mike, AC2NJI, has his website, amateurradio.tv, where he archives all of the technical nets that go as far back as September of 2006. So please take a look at them. They're very interesting, and most of the information is still up to date. Nothing's really proven itself wrong. So let me drop for a sec. Okay, before we start tonight's technical net, I want to mention that recently a windstorm has knocked down all of my antennas except for one. I am thankfully left with at least one UHF-VHF antenna, which I use to do these technical nets and the other things that I do on UHF-VHF. But all the rest are down, and I had very thankfully Andy, WA2CDL, and a friend Tony, W2ASC, come by and take a look. And what we really need is one or two more spry guys with ladder skills. You need a 40-foot ladder, unfortunately, to get to my roof over an awning. And the plan is for either later this week or Sunday morning, if we can find a couple of people who are kind of spry and easily climb up ladders without too much of a problem, and they don't mind being in Brooklyn for a few hours and want to help a ham out, I would deeply appreciate it. So if you're inclined, contact Andy, WA2CDL, because he's coordinating that, and I will be very thankful if I can get my antennas up before the winter hits. So let me drop for a sec. Okay, as always, what we plan to do is open the technical net for any questions or topics. You can tell me your name and your call sign, and we'll put you on the list and take you in order of your checking in. Sometime around 8:30, we will pause for between 8:30 and 9 o'clock, depending upon how things are going, for Andy's Corner. Andy will be concluding his topic on impedance matching, and I look forward to that. When he's done with that, I will return for any further questions or comments, and maybe we'll discuss a couple of science articles in the news. And around 10:15 or 10:30, we'll call upon Paul to give us the SpaceNet report. So that's the plan for tonight, and let's kick it into motion. Anyone who has a question or a topic tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
Feedback to me to OAY, Joe.
Okay, Joe recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight?
Into AXN with the science report news after Andy's corner, if you could hit me.
Okay, Wes, I have you written down there. We'll see how the night progresses and... When we have the time, I will summon you forth. How's that?
Okay, thank you very much, but after Andy's corner.
Yes, I understand, Wesley. Anyone else want to put their name down for any questions or comments tonight, please?
WB2HRO, I have a question. And want some advice about antennas and dealing with, I live in an apartment house. Over.
Okay, very good. Your first name is Joe, correct?
Correct.
Okay, Joe, we got you down. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, very good. We will take WA2RYY, Joe number one. What's your question or your comment tonight?
Okay, good evening, Ryan. WA2RYY. Question is a little, I guess, off the mainstream, which you don't normally talk about, but of amateur radio interest probably. I'm looking to find out what the pulse width of ignition noise that comes out of a motor vehicle would be. I figured out at 1,000 RPMs, like a typical motor V8, the pulse period between ignition firings is something like 15 milliseconds, but I don't know the pulse width. Anybody have an idea where I can maybe find this information or know firsthand themselves what this piece of data I'm looking for would be? Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Joe. Does anyone out there know the answer to Joe's question, the pulse width of noise coming out of motor vehicles? It appears that no one quite knows. I assume you've tried your friend and mine, Google.
I haven't tried that first, but I guess it's what I'm going to probably have to do. So if there's no answers here, I'll seek the answer elsewhere.
Yeah, it's a bit on the esoteric side, so I'm not at all surprised. But just in case someone just came to the radio, 10 seconds ago, Joe, WA2RYY, is looking for some information of the pulse width of the noise produced by motor vehicles. If anyone knows that, I assume it's going to end up being a range because the timing of vehicles changes and different models, so it's probably more likely to be a significant range than a absolute number.
BDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
I think it might be related to the dwell angle, but now that's the time that the point or transistor stays closed to build up the current in the coil. The actual noise is generated when the current is interrupted and the plug fires. Go ahead.
Okay, but that noise discharge isn't instantaneous, so it has its own width, right?
Yes, and that, I guess, would be related something with the time constant of the coil along probably with that capacitor. Now, I'm thinking old-style ignition, but I think it would be related with that time constant with that capacitor that's across the point or transistor.
Okay, makes sense. What factors do you think would modulate that, would shift it one way or the other? I get the sense that it's not something that's kind of locked down, but it's probably subject to a few variables and how the engine works.
Yeah, well obviously engine RPM is going to do it. I'm wondering, you can probably, I don't know where you would look for it, but I have seen the waveforms which show the coil current as the plug fires. It looks like a kind of ringing circuit there, but you might get some information from that. Of course, it's going to change with RPM.
Question, it's broadband noise, though. It's all over the band.
Yeah, the noise is broadband, but Joe's question was the width of the individual pulses of the broad-based noise. And again, my gut sense, having no knowledge of the ultimate answer, is that it's highly variable on a very large number of factors. So I don't even begin to guess at how wide the range is going to be if we find any kind of reasonable article on the subject. Oh, well, I guess that's it on this topic for tonight. Joe, WA2RYY, if you come up with any kind of specific answer, please feel free to drop on by again and tell us what you found. Because, I'm interested in knowing that. And I will do a couple little Google searches. I've already tried a few of them, and unfortunately I end up getting entries about pulse width modulation as opposed to the pertinent topic. So it's not high on Google's list, but I'll look further into it, and I'm sure you will. And if you find something, let us know.
Okay, I will. The reason I'm looking to know this, to get an approximate idea, is because if I can use a pulse generator to modulate my signal generator, which is an HP8640, which has a way of being modulated with a pulse information, that gives me a controllable amplitude source that I can direct into a receiver with a directional coupler alongside a signal generator directly coupled into the receiver. Therefore, I can measure how much the effectiveness, the noise blanking circuit in the receiver actually works versus the amplitude of incoming noise. Back to you.
Oh, okay. Well, that's certainly a useful bit of information. Again, if you get to that point, let us know.
Okay, very good. Thanks for answering the question, and on to the next one. WHYY.
Okay, we'll now go to our second Joe of the evening, WB2HRO. What's your question tonight? I gather it's something about antennas, and the people out there love to discuss antennas.
Well, I'm in a stalemate here with the people in this place I live in about, I don't know, they now have a thing about antennas. I live here 13 years, and I've always had a wire out my window, a long wire of some kind, for the low bands, for the last 12 years anyway. I'd like to know if, first of all, has anybody else had problems in places where they lived in a multiple dwelling, and how they resolved it, and also, what kind of antennas would you recommend you know, I'm trying to figure out a long wire with a tuner is the way I've been doing it. Of course, they keep stealing the wire. I have an end-fed half wave, but I hesitate to put it out because they're going to cut it up. And maybe there's some kind of shortened whip that would work. I want to work 80 through 10. That's my goal, especially 80. So that's a little bit of a challenge, I guess. Back to Nick.
Okay, Joe, it probably would be better if you give us a better feel for the area that you can put it in. I get the sense there's a great deal of vandalism going on. So is there any area, you know, a little alcove that goes out from your apartment, your home, whatever it might be, and that's somewhat protected, or is everything that's beyond your window, the outside world that anyone can vandalize?
Well, if it's just on my windowsill or on top of my air conditioner, as long as they can't reach it, I'm on the sixth floor, it's all right. But if it's like the simple antenna I had, which was going across the yard to a part of the next building, that was, I could reach it to put it up. So, you know, the far end was, you know, maybe 10 feet off the ground. It wouldn't be there very long, and they cut it up. So I'm thinking of if there's anything I could mount on my window or on my air conditioner that would not be in the reach of the undesirable. That's what I mean. And still work. That's my thought. I thought of a mobile whip. They make various, they're not cheap, but if they would work, using the top of the air conditioner and the metal windowsill as a counterpoise. You know, I wonder if anybody has played with those kind of antennas. Back to you.
Okay, Joe, I'll throw it out to the audience. I just want to put in my two cents. I think you're alluding to basically a shortened vertical with a loading coil, a very popular design in mobile situations, the hamsticks and such. Hamsticks are decent at 10 meters, maybe at 20. The problem is, though, as you get lower in the frequency, the efficiency of these devices tend to be very poor, to the point that I've seen measurements where 80-meter hamsticks can be as low as 2% efficiency. The problem is that as you shorten a quarter wave vertical, you diminish the radiation resistance, and the insertion losses become a greater and greater factor, and the insertion loss and the coil capacitive and inductive losses add up, and the efficiencies don't really add up at 80 meters. It's certainly doable at 10. It might be tolerable at 20. People do use them at 80, but don't expect to hear a lot of things. I'm a big fan of magnetic loops. Usually they're better outdoors than they ever are indoors. Sometimes people put them right against the window and they get away with it. They're relatively small, compact. They don't need elevation. The only limitation is that because of the very, very high Q, they have very, very high voltages across the tuning capacitor. So that tends to be a limitation. You can't put out a lot of watts through a magnetic loop. And you have to keep tuning it because of the high Q. But magnetic loops are always a reasonable option. So those are the two things that pop into my mind. I'll open it to the audience. If anyone has any suggestions for something that can't be vandalized, that stays out of the range of people who want to wreak havoc, please let me know.
K2GJE at Coben.
Yes, Ed.
Evening, Roy. I don't have any trees, and I don't really have any place to anchor a dipole. I've had 80-meter single-band whip on a 10-foot pole for quite a number of years. I think half the width is a coil, about, there's about 3 foot of coil, and then there's about maybe another 6 feet of wire. I've had good success with it. Worked up in Canada and with no problem, and down south with no problem. But I know 80 is better at night, over.
Well, yeah, 80 meters and 160 meters is bedeviled by an energized deionospheric layer. So it's pretty much a dead band during the day. As I said, a shortened antenna with a loading coil will tune, and sometimes you don't need a lot of efficiency to get out. Sometimes propagation conditions just work for you. There's a story I keep telling about a guy who took a 100-watt incandescent light bulb, put it on a wooden fence post, and after a few months of using it, got a worked all states out of it. So it's more in the individual than anything else, and so that's one vote for basically a ham stick. Elevations, as you mentioned, is important. You want to get it off the ground unless you have a lot of conducting wire to shield it from ground loss. So I guess 10 feet is enough. Anyone else with any opinions of a antenna for Joe that would lessen the risks of being vandalized? You know, simple wires are a beautiful thing, but inevitably, unless you can attach them very high, they're an open invitation for vandals.
I had to step out of the room for a minute. I didn't get the, this is WB2HRO. The one he said that he used for years on 80, what was it? Was it something he made or something that he bought?
I don't believe he gave a brand, but I could be wrong. Ed, K2GJE, was that a store-bought antenna, or did you make it yourself?
K2GJE. No, it was store-bought, one of these single-band whips that they advertise in QST on a flexible mobile mount on top of a 10-foot pole, and it worked very well for me. I don't have anything here to anchor wire to, and it was the easiest thing to put out. As a matter of fact, I remember using it one weekend when we have field day. Of course, there was a lot of people on 80 on field day, and it worked very well, over.
Was there a counterpoise?
The only counterpoise is the fact that the 10-foot pole has a 35-pound cast iron base, and it has a rod going through the base into the ground. It just has a good ground without any ground wires, and SWR was very good on it, and it was about maybe, I would say, maybe 30 feet of coax going to it, over.
And you don't know, but it was made for 80 meters, and you didn't have trouble on, you know, the whole range of the band from 3.5 to 4. All right, well, it's something to think about. How long was the coil and the antenna? It was on a 10-foot pole, but in my case, it would be mounted to the windowsill, which is metal, so that would... But how long was the whole thing?
If you give me a minute, it happens to be in the basement at the moment. I'll come back here in just 2 minutes. I'm going to put a ruler on it, over.
All right, very good. So when you come back, back to net, that would be 2HRO.
Okay, very good. We'll wait for Ed to come back with the measurements. I suspect that there's probably a degree of the outer shield of the coax acting as a bit of a counterpoise as well. Be interesting when Ed gets back if he had to put any ferrite clamps on it to diminish common mode getting back into the shack. While we wait for Ed to come back, anyone else who has any war stories of antennas that they think would suit Joe's needs? Gosh, I would have thought that there would be a lot of war stories of different antennas, because if there's one thing that hams like to talk about is the different antennas that they've used. I've used the magnetic loops. I've used fan dipoles, NFEDs, quarter wave with radials, collinears, probably a few I've forgotten. But sort of surprised that no one has any war stories about antennas. And usually, especially in the metropolitan area, if there's ever an area that has compromised shortened antennas. I mean, Dick used to tell about the infinitesimal dipole. So that's the magic bullet that many hams are looking for, a very small radiating antenna that does things efficiently and doesn't take up too much volume.
KD2NFJ, Roy.
Yes, Sam.
Yes, I saw one before by MFJ. It's 1622, the number. It's $103, but it's perfect. It sits in the ledge of your window. It's made that way. It's like a metal frame, and it sits right in the shock of your window, so you can close the window. I'm looking at it now, Roy. Wait a minute. It's 10 meters with 2 meters up to 40 meters, okay? And it's like, what do you call them, the screwdriver ones? Like you move the screw on the side where the wires are to what band you want. So you might need a, what do you call it, a tuner setup. They come with a tuner setup also for like $160, and you tune the station right away. But it's on MFJ, it's on the computer.
K2GJE.
Yes, Ed.
Okay, I measured it. The coil is 45 inches. I assume the coil also radiates. And then after the coil is another 45 inches of straight wire. So the whole thing is 90 inches over.
So did you get that, Joe?
Yeah, I got that. So, and that works on 80 meters, I assume, right?
That's correct. It works on, it was 80 meters. It's a single band antenna. I used to use it on 3885, the AM calling frequency, because I'm a great fan of AM, and I have a transmitter that I built in the 50s that's at least 150 watts AM, and I used to use it on that, over.
I understand. And you didn't have a counterpoise, or what did you do for a counterpoise, or what, over?
No real counterpoise as far as, you know, running radial wires. It does have a base about 2 feet in diameter of cast iron, and through the center of that runs another piece of tubing down into the ground. So it has a very good ground at the antenna, and it is 10 feet above the dirt, and then just the coax running back to the transmitter through an SWR bridge, and it was very fine business. Over.
Yeah, it's a shortened whip, basically. I understand. And you don't know who made that, do you?
Oh, I don't know who made it. It's had it a long time. It was advertised in QST. I think there's other people advertising single band whips in QST. Over.
Okay. I'll call a few of the places, check it out. What was I going to say? Net control. What is the, how big is the magnetic loop? Because they're funny because you have to tune them all the time because they're very narrow banded. But how big was your magnetic loop and what band did it cover? Over.
Magnetic loops usually go at around 3 feet in diameter, depending upon the loading coil, the coil for tuning, not the coil, the capacitor for tuning. They, you know, some of them rate it all the way from 10 to 80. Usually, it has a particular sweet spot and a particular efficiency in one portion of that long band, but theoretically speaking, if it has the proper capacitor, you can tune it across the band. It is problematic as far as it has such a high Q. You have to retune it if you're going to change it by just a few kilohertz. Sometimes, if you pay extra, they have automated systems that check the SWR and auto-tune for you, but that's an extra cost. So there's a downside to it being that it has to be retuned during every change in frequency, and usually you can't push that many watts through it because the capacitor, unless it's a vacuum capacitor, will arc eventually. I think what Sam was mentioning is basically another version of a loaded whip. In that case, there's, I think, an alligator clip that fits to shorten the inductance coil depending upon what frequency you're trying to resonate the whip to. It's a very simple design. It is limited to 40 and above. It has somewhat efficiency problems as well, and you have to be able to get to it and change the little alligator clip if you're changing the frequency much.
I had the MFJ version of that, and that lasted only a very short time. And the coil corroded, and I couldn't get a good connection. It was an MFJ, and it was $100, and it just was. It worked. It was the 40-6 or whatever, but it didn't last long enough. If it was made better, if it was made of stainless steel wire instead of copper or aluminum, it would have worked, but it didn't. And they could have made an 80 version easily, just make it a little bigger. But you know, it didn't work on any band after about 2 months. So what can I say? So the magnetic loop, but I guess, I wonder how big in diameter they come, you know, if you, you know, over.
As I've mentioned, most of the ones that I've seen are approximately 3 feet in diameter. You know, 1 meter or 3 feet. It depends whether you want to be imperial or metric.
I understand. All right, that's enough information, and I guess they're available. It would be nice if they made one that would tune automatically, because it's going to be a problem for me to tune it all the time. I mean, when I had the MFJ loaded whip, you know, thing with the alligator clip, the only way I did it was I tuned it for the maximum noise. And then I use the automatic tuner, the tuner in the radio to, you know, do a little more tweaking. It worked, except, as I said, it stopped working. And I threw the whole thing out. I still have part of it, but it's useless. Anyway, back to Ned.
Yeah, that's why they call it Mighty Fine Junk. If you're willing, you know, there are different price points for magnetic loops, and there are a lot of forums and websites of people who teach other people how to get some copper tubing that's usually used as a refrigerator water supply and build their own magnetic loops. But if you want to go commercial, they make them all price points. There are some that are designed out of basically coax cable, so you can collapse it down into a little bag and take it mobile. And others use a copper pipe. Copper is better than the aluminum in that the insertion losses are less. And you can get them where they auto-tune. You just have to be willing to pay that additional premium. Amateurs don't like to pay too many premiums. So I understand that not everyone goes for it. But they do have auto-tuning magnetic loops, and they have high-end, semi-ridiculous magnetic loops. There's a place in Italy called Ciro that makes these gargantuan industrial-size magnetic loops that use interlacing claw fingers as the capacitor. Those things can take as much as, I think, 300 watts, but they cost thousands of dollars. But, you know, getting back into the real world, again, there are magnetic loops that have auto-tuning capability for a price.
Yeah, okay. Very good. I think I have enough information to start doing a little more inquiry. Anyway, back to you, and we'll go on to the next topic.
Okay, good luck, Joe. And please, if you find a solution and want to share it with us, please drop by again and tell us how the story ends.
I think the easiest way to solve the problem is get these people to stop cutting my antenna down would be the easiest way. But I don't know. I think this is the end. With COVID-19, people have nothing fit to do but to be petty. You know what I mean? They're home all day and they can just, I don't know. All I can say is these people are, it's a sad scene. Anyway, I'm not going to give up too easily. Because I've been a ham for 57 years, and I intend to be a ham for another 57 years. And as long as I live here, I intend to be on the air. And I've been here 13 years, and I've been on the air about 11 or 12 years of that. Over.
That's very good. And I hope you get your wish and continue on. It's a fascinating hobby. I wish it is far easier to explain how antennas work than how human beings work. So changing the nature of problematic people is something that would take way too many nets.
That is true. You know, I know how to measure wire and to splice wire, but I don't know how to modify people. If you know what I mean, their brains. Anyway, have a thanks a lot. WB2HRO.
You're welcome, Joe. Be safe, be well, and let us summon upon us Andy, WA2CDL, with this episode of Andy's Corner.
Okay. Maggie Roy, this is WHCDL. Let me just turn the volume down here and get myself situated. And welcome to Andy's Corner, another episode of the famous Andy's Corner. And we will try to keep muddling through the topics that come about us and come up against us and all that stuff. And I think tonight will be the last episode of the one that I've been talking about for the past number of weeks, even a few months, and that is dealing with the impedance matching. using coax cables, especially. So I just got to make sure not to time it out, because I have a tendency to do that. And again, this is Andy's Corner, and my name is Andy, of course. Makes sense. And we should wrap this up tonight. You know, again, just to mention to everyone, you know, I'm not getting into mathematics, I'm not getting into engineering, I'm not going into the design, I'm just giving an overview of what is written in different magazines that I happen to pull out on topics that we can all learn from, because there's always stuff to learn, especially me, and the problem is that as I get older, I forget what I learn. You know, I think the best way that I've learned over the years is just by doing something, physically doing it, putting something together, or troubleshooting, or whatever. You know, reading something, it sounds good, but if I don't actually do it, I don't remember it as much, and I forget and all that stuff. So we're going to just continue with that, with the subject of impedance matching. Even though I have not done any experiments, I've not had any much time to do any experiments, but I am curious about it, and maybe one day I will do some of the things that have been mentioned. So let me let it drop. Okay. I always like to start off with a little overview of what we've covered in the past, because we did a lot of, from the very beginning, you know, I took excerpts from a different magazine and spoke about coax cable and told you guys, whoever's still listening, you know, about coax cables, basically what they do and how they work and the various things you could do with them. And it's kind of interesting how you can make coax cables is more than just a piece of coax that's transmitting power from one place to another, from your, you know, from your rig to your antenna. It also performs, like this article says, you know, you can use it for impedance matching in different ways. You could also use it as filters, like stub filters, stub tuning filters, which is what we discovered and discussed last week about using stubs. So I'm not going to go into all that again, because, you know, after a while, I get the feeling, even for myself, you know, I want to move on to other topics. So I'm going to, you know, again, we'll wrap this up tonight. There's only just a few more paragraphs. And I'm not going to go into everything that I mentioned in the past, because there's no need to. I did mention a few articles that even Roy wrote down. YouTube videos you can see. Plenty of books on antennas and three-point matching coax cable matching, like I'm talking about, and other things. So there's plenty of articles out here, and I'm just, again, just giving an overview of what we, you know, what's going on. Okay, one more time. Let me let it drop. All right, very good. I don't have that much time tonight because I got a couple other things that got in the way, partially due to the weather. And as Roy mentioned, I saw Roy this morning. I was trying to help him out, but we have to continue this project to helping out Roy. So if anybody out there is willing to help Roy with the antennas, you know, he's nice to give us the tech net. I'm obligated to pay him back, at least get the antennas up for him. And the antennas, yeah, they're vulnerable for sure. You get a storm that's got high winds, and we don't get storms like we got that often. The one back in August, but that was a bad storm. It affected me. It took down my antennas as well. So anyway, okay. So last week, I spoke about basically transmission line stubs. That was the article, the part of the article that I was talking about, and how we could use stubs to act as bandpass or notch filters and so on. And, you know, using a shorted stub or an open stub at a certain wavelength because of the impedance inversion that a quarter wave gives, you can use the stub to filter out a second harmonic or third harmonic and so on. So, again, I'm not going to go into the article again, but just mentioning that we spoke about that last week. Now, where I left off was antenna feed point matching. So we were talking about coax cable impedance matching using different lengths of coax cables at different wavelengths. But now there's just a few mentions here of how to do it at the antenna itself. And of course, if any of you guys work with antennas, which you're just talking about, you can see how the coax cable is connected to the antenna. There's different ways of doing it, whether it's a vertical antenna, a beam antenna, or anything in between. You have to have a way of connecting the coax cable so the efficiency is good, and it'll transform most or all of your power from your transmission line to the antenna. So let me let it drop. So I guess, it makes sense, if you think about it, that you have a piece of coax cable, let's say is 50 ohms, like RG8 or RG213 or LMR400, all of those. You want to have an antenna that also offers a 50 ohm impedance for the impedances to be matched. And when the impedances are matched, that's when you get your maximum power transfer. And, of course, your SWR is low, and you're not going to get reflected power and all that stuff that goes on. So you want to match your feed point, your antenna impedance, to match your coax cable impedance. So this is what it says, okay, and we'll just briefly touch on this. And then again, there's a lot of reference material if you want to do some further studying and reading about it. So it says here, antenna feed point matching. Rather than match antenna impedance somewhere in the feed line or back at the transmitter, it is preferable to provide a feed point impedance of 50 ohms for direct connection of feed lines. 50 ohms for direct connection of feed lines. Okay, so that means at the antenna. Modern antenna design tools make that increasingly popular, but there are still many antennas that have feed point impedances quite a bit different than 50 ohms. Yeah, and a lot of people, most of you guys know about all the different antenna software programs that are out there. Like, and I've used one a long time ago. What is it called? EZNIC, NIC. I think that's the way I'm saying it, but maybe I'm not quite sure. and there's many others that you could just look up in some matching antennas or matching feed impedances, some feed lines, making stubs and all that. There's plenty of information on the internet. So you could put an antenna tuner right at the feed point, but it is less expensive in most cases to use one of the common matching structures instead. Now, I use an antenna tuner, by the way, because I'm using a dipole antenna on 75 meters, if Joe's still listening, and it's a regular half-wave dipole. It's not exactly a half-wave. It's a little bit too short, but I'm tuning... Or matching.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, W8-CDL, let me just let it drop. Boy, that's embarrassing, timing it out, but it's all too much. I'm using my antenna tuner to compensate for the mismatch at my feed point of my dipole, you know, given what frequency that I'm tuning on 75 meters, and it's very sharp. So what I do is I just retune the antenna to it if I change frequencies on 75 meters, and then, of course, everything is fine. Everything is fine even before that, but I do get a little bit more RF coming back in the shack, which I can actually detect. So, so again, I can put an antenna tuner right at the feed point, but it is less expensive in most cases to use one at the common matching structure instead. These mount directly on or at the antenna and require adjustment at the antenna. You have to adjust them. Typically, they are single-band solutions. The Gala match and the Beta match or hairpin match are the most common. Yeah, now you've seen the Gamma match. When you tune a beam, you can slide a piece of a metal that's parallel to one of the to the boom and connects to the driven element, and you actually adjust the place on that. I'm trying to describe it, but you probably know what I'm talking about. You adjust it so at a certain length. Because the impedance changes along the line, so you move it back and forth. You loosen the screw and you move this other piece of metal that connects the feed point from the coax to the driven element, and you slide it back and forth and you match it that way. And of course, you use instruments to do it. You use an SWR meter or what have you, and you get the lowest SWO, which means now you're matched or pretty close to it at the frequency that you're transmitting on. Now, some of these, depending on, again, the antenna and the Q of the antenna, will determine the bandwidth of the antenna. Some have a pretty wide bandwidth, so you match it at the center of the frequency that you're using, and then you slide your frequency up and down the band until you see a 2-to-1 SWR. Well, let me let it drop again. Yeah, I've spoken about this before. What specifications usually show a bandwidth of an antenna as a 2-to-1 SWR points, and which means that you move the frequency up purposely until your SWR goes up to 2-to-1. And then you move your frequency down until you see the same thing, a 2-to-1 SWR, and that from one end to the other end is basically a 2-to-1 bandwidth of your antenna. I think that's one of the ways they specify the bandwidth of the antenna. Of course, depending on the design of the antenna, will determine how wide the bandwidth or how narrow the bandwidth is. In my case, with this dipole, it's pretty sharp. And you got to do it slowly and carefully. You'll look for a dip where you'll see that'll be the resonant point where my SWR meter will dip down momentarily. If I move my capacitor quickly in the antenna tuner, I wouldn't see it. So you gotta do it slowly. And there's a technique for it. So, let me let it drop again. Alright, so in regard to the Gamma match, or the Beta match, hairpin match, the ones I just mentioned. I'll talk about the Gamma match. The Gamma match is an evolution of two earlier techniques. It is actually the combination of the Delta match and the T match. Now, the problem with talking about all this is you really have to see what it looks like. A T match looks like a T. A delta looks more like a triangle, like a delta, like a Y. And it says, as seen in Figure 3. Now, I can't show you what Figure 3 looks like, but if you visualize a piece of 450-ohm ladder line, I'm using that specifically as an example, not coax cable, ladder line, and then at the end of the ladder line, you strip it, some bare wire, and then you fan it outwards so that the right side of the lateral line is at an angle, like a 45-degree angle. Left side is at a 45-degree angle, and you connect it to your dipole antenna. Now that now looks like a delta. It's got the shape of a Y because it's spanning outwards on both sides, and you got a certain distance between the two ends. So that's really showing what they call a delta match because of that delta shape of the triangle. Then you got a T match, which is similar, but now it's going straight instead of at an angle, and so on. It's hard to, again, explain, to visualize the different type of matches other than the way I'm describing it, what this article is showing. So, the gamma match is an evolution of two earlier techniques, the delta match and the T match, as seen in Figure 3. These techniques were used to match wire antenna impedances to open wire line with impedances around 600 ohms. Let me let it drop again. Okay. The delta match simply connected the feed point, or the feed line, to the points on the antenna with the right impedance as determined by the A and the B dimensions, which I'm adding that word in because they don't tell you that. The dimensions of what they show you here. The T-match created two short transmission line sections in each side of the antenna, transforming the impedance so that the feed line... Oh, I'm sorry, I just didn't read it right. Transforming the impedance to that of the feed line. The lighting in my room is pretty dim. To that of the feed line. So it's transforming the impedance to the feed line of the antenna. So that's what I'm saying. That's what I just said. The gamma match is actually one half of a T match and is used with unbalanced antennas in which the driven element is connected directly to the boom and the antenna support. Supports, which are at DC ground potential. I got to look at the commas and the periods. They look similar. They look the same. So a support comma, which are at DC ground potential. So that's what the antenna is. At that point is a DC ground, at that point in the antenna. This is a low impedance point on the driven element, and aside from leading to imbalances in driven element current, it is convenient and sturdy. Okay, so that's basically your gamma match. And again, you know, you can read up on this, another article on gamma matching for this particular antenna. And we're actually talking about a dipole. In this case, no, I didn't mean dipole because this is a gamma match. The delta and T matches for a dipole, the gamma match is usually a beam antenna on the driven element, as I mentioned earlier. All right, let me let it drop. Okay, we're almost done with this, so you could, you'll have a sigh of relief in a few minutes. And then we'll move on to something else some other time. All right, so basically that's the overview of the gamma match. They mention also the beta or hairpin match. And that is the beta or hairpin match is electrically an L network in which the driven element is deliberately made shorter than resident to have a somewhat capacitive feed point. Okay, so that's important. So now you have something that's deliberately made shorter than the resident point. Because you want it to be capacitive. The hairpin inductor connected across the feed point transforms the driven element impedance to a pure resistance. And they show, again, a picture of it. So, because you're doing this, it's an L network in which the driven element is deliberately made shorter. So it has, so it's an L network, it's a coil, but you have a certain capacitive feed point impedance.